Welcome to Divorce Talk, a podcast for people who are contemplating divorce, going through one, or would like to know everything about the divorce process. Each episode, you'll hear from Chicago divorce lawyers from Bierman LLP, one of the largest divorce and family law firms in the state of Illinois, speak on all things divorce, from child custody, divorce litigation, mediation, the collaborative process, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, the Bierman Divorce Lawyers.
Hi, I'm Sandra Napoli-Diargo. I'm here today with Tom Field and Michael Seven, divorce and family law partners at Bierman. Today, we'll be speaking about divorce 101, a lot of questions that you may have if you are contemplating a divorce, how to call a divorce lawyer, when you should call a divorce lawyer, questions you should ask, how you should prep, all the things that you really are not familiar with. Hopefully, you'll have a better understanding at the end of this podcast. But before we do that, I'd like to introduce Tom and have him share a little bit about himself as well as Michael.
So Tom Field, I'm the head of our matrimonial practice here at Bierman and been with Bierman now since 2006, specializing and practicing only in the area of family and matrimonial law for that entire period of time. As far as my background goes, I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago in Highland Park, went to U of I for my undergrad, came back to Chicago for law school and business school. So I'm a JD MBA, very much enjoyed dealing with the financial nature of divorce and all that goes along with it. I live in the city with my wife and two boys, and that's about me. So Michael, why don't you take it over?
My name is Michael Seven. I'm an attorney at Bierman as well. I've been practicing at Bierman since the end of 2011. I did my undergraduate studies at Indiana University in Bloomington and went to law school at DePaul. I practice in litigation. I'm pretty comfortable in the courtroom, and I also live in Chicago as well.
Excellent. Well, let's get started. So Tom, let's get started with you. If I'm a client or a potential client, let's say, and I'm contemplating getting a divorce, the first thing I probably will do is ask friends and family or search the internet. Take me through the process before I even step through the door.
Sure.
What should I be doing?
Well, listen, everybody is more comfortable with a warm referral, so to speak. So if somebody you know knows somebody, it always feels more comfortable, at least because, at least in theory, they've had an experience or there's a relationship. I get that and I can appreciate that. It doesn't mean that that relationship is necessarily a good one. It doesn't mean that that person necessarily knows really well the practitioner, but it's still a comfort level. So we as practitioners can appreciate that our former clients in particular and other lawyers that don't practice in our area are typically our best referral sources. Now, of course, we get clients or prospective clients calling us who are uncomfortable talking to a friend or a relative. We get that too. I've had CEOs contact me because they found me online through a law directory or some other methodology because they don't want anybody knowing their business. They want to keep their matter private and they're doing their own due diligence, so to speak, and their own investigation. And there are plenty of places for them to look to do that as well. There's one website in particular called avvo.com that is not necessarily unique in our space, but different in that our former clients can go on and post reviews about us and either remain anonymous or not. In doing so, that's their choice. But it's a public repository of feedback that is rare in the professional services world because, especially in law, you don't get that anywhere else for the most part. I know we as a firm are working on providing our potential clients with other avenues to learn about us, including these podcasts. But there are definitely resources out there and super lawyers and leading lawyers websites as well where people can learn about us.
Okay. Tom, I'll ask Michael about this. I know you mentioned CEOs come to the firm and they don't want people knowing their business. Michael, how does the firm handle privacy if I am a CEO or really anyone for that matter? I'm coming to your office. I don't want my neighbor knowing. I don't want the press knowing. I don't want anyone knowing that I'm even thinking of speaking to a divorce lawyer. How do you, as an attorney, and how does the firm handle the privacy of that potential new client?
Well, as a starting point, when you reach out to an attorney, everything is protected by the attorney-client privilege. So the communications that a potential client, whether they sign up with you or not, is going to be deemed privileged if the expectation is that it's kept privileged. A lot of times people will come with a parent or a friend just for comfort level, and we have to advise them at that time the presence of a third party in the meeting will get rid of that privilege. So if there's something in particular that they want to keep privileged, we'll ask that person to step out of the room, but we'll assure them that whatever they tell us, whatever information they provide us that's expected to be kept confidential will be, and we can't be ordered to divulge that information either because that's part of the privilege as well. So anything they come to us and advise us of and the information that we provide them back is governed by privilege and it's kept entirely confidential. And that includes documents they provide us with, et cetera. Anything they provide us that we save is kept on secure drives and in the cloud with password protection to ensure that that privilege is kept in place.
And if I am calling you, Tom, but my husband met with you yesterday, or my husband decides to call you tomorrow, how does that work?
So we have a very sophisticated conflict system in the office where if somebody, one spouse reaches out to us before we have any meaningful conversation with them whatsoever, they are run through our conflict system to make sure that we have not been contacted by or spoken with their spouse and that we haven't done any work for them, either of the parties or any closely held business that they may own in the past. So we really make a strong effort to protect, again, the confidentiality, but also the security of information flow, because we don't want a circumstance like that where you contact me one day, but your husband's already been here. I can't sit down and schedule that meeting with you unless and until I confirm that we don't have a conflict.
Mm-hmm. So what if you've met with my husband, but he doesn't hire you? Can you then represent me?
So it's a really good question. And it actually comes up a fair amount in our world because at the high end of the practice, which is where our firm's at, there are some usual suspects as far as our competition goes. And we are typically vying for the best cases in the Chicagoland area. So we at Bierman are very careful about staying within the parameters of the ethical guidelines. And there are rules of professional responsibility that will allow us to take on a representation in that circumstance where, by way of example, you've met with us, don't elect to hire us, and then your husband wants to hire one of my partners. Now, the way that typically will work is if you met with me and somebody on my team, anybody in our office that could have come across you or your notes that we may have taken will be Chinese walled off physically from your file and electronically.
What does that mean?
So it means that no lawyers, paralegals, or paraprofessionals in our office could access any notes that we had kept from a meeting with you. And those people would be walled off from that information so that if your husband decided he wanted to hire Michael and Michael wasn't part of the team that sat in on your consult, they could take on that representation, assuming that you didn't sign an engagement letter with us and pay us a retainer.
Okay, good information. Michael, what could I expect from my first meeting, from the time I arrive into the office? Or let me just take a step back. Before I even arrive in the office, how many people should I reach out to? How many attorneys should I reach out to?
Well, I would start with one in particular, and then it's a comfort level between the attorney and the client. We'd hope that they would come to us and stay with us. But part of what we do in that initial meeting is to not only gather information from the potential client that we would need for preparing a case, but also to educate potential client who's coming in about how the process works, what they're looking at, what the issues might be, and how they might be viewed or treated by a judge throughout the process. So a good deal of what we do in the initial consultation is educating them on what the law provides, how long it will take, how much it will cost them, which are a couple of things we really can't predict to some extent, which we'll go into more in a moment, but also educating them on what the law says with respect to child-related issues, financial issues, and the status of their marriage itself in terms of filing and all of those areas of the law.
Tom, what type of questions can I expect in our initial meeting with a divorce lawyer? And do I need to sign, I'm not sure what the exact language is, an engagement letter with the attorney after the first meeting?
So let me work backwards there. You are not compelled to sign an engagement letter in our presence at that first meeting unless you are ready to go and you love us and trust us and want us to handle your case. I'm confident that you will love us, trust us, and want us to handle your case, but not everybody feels super comfortable just being handed a pen and asked to sign that day and at that time. I make it a practice to give every potential client proposed engagement letter when they leave or email it to them immediately thereafter so that they have it in hand and are ready to move forward whenever they're most comfortable doing it. As it relates to the new client meetings, though, I would say I at least break them down probably into 5 parts if I had to guess. As Michael said, it's about education. So the first part of the meeting, I may inquire of the potential client as to why they're here specifically, what brought on the circumstance in their life that made them take that leap, which is not an easy one, to call us or email us or whatever they did to reach out. So I get a little flavor of the case, the personalities perhaps, and some baseline data. Then I'll go into the process a little bit about how somebody needs to file the case. And then we go into the discovery phase and the settlement phase. I'll also walk them through the law as it relates to property division, child support, maintenance, which is our term for alimony. And then we'll talk about all the different aspects of that based on a little bit of factual information that they've given me. We typically will do a little bit more data gathering as the meeting goes, as far as their children, as far as their finances go. It is not imperative for somebody to be intimately knowledgeable of their finances. That's always information that we can get down the road. Whatever they do know is certainly helpful or have access to, and we'll walk them through that as well. And then we talk to them about a couple variables that always play into every single case, which are how their spouse is going to behave and who their spouse hires to represent them. And those two variables will absolutely 100% of the time impact how long the case takes to resolve and how much it ultimately costs.
I'm overwhelmed just by that, right? So from a layperson's point of view, Michael, what would be your advice to someone? So I met with Tom and he's gone through all this information and my head is this big because this is not what I do every day. What recommendations would you give as far as prepping for this initial meeting and then leaving the meeting so that you're not so overwhelmed? How much handholding do the divorce attorneys give to their clients?
Well, at an initial consultation, I think as far as information they should gather ahead of time, it's a good idea to pull things like tax returns or any type of financial net worth statements that they might have prepared. Tax returns are always a good place as a starting point because it gives the attorney a bit of a window into the finances of the family, both in terms of what each of them may make. If they file jointly, it would indicate both parties' income, as well as certain, if they own a business, the health of the business, the financial health of the business. what types of investments they might have. The tax return gives a bit of a window into their finances. As it relates to how much handholding we do in the case, it really depends on how involved that spouse was with their finances. Tom was talking about this a moment ago as well. So it's not unusual for one of the spouses to come in who typically hasn't handled their finances throughout the marriage. And that's something we deal with throughout cases and will just require a little bit more discovery on that end. So part of it, what we do is assure them that we have the ability to obtain this information and what we'll need them to do in terms of gathering us the background of where to look as a starting point for them.
I would follow on to the handholding question though too. Something I always try to impart on a potential client is they're not just any client. This is a professional services business. And one of the things that we strive for at Bierman is the client service aspect. And that just doesn't mean that we service the case and send our clients on their way either. So when it comes to that handholding piece, especially for the spouse who hasn't been intimately involved in the finances, we're always looking to make sure that we set them up so that they have a new estate plan when they leave us, so that they have a new accountant when they leave us, so that they have a new financial advisor when they leave us, so that they have proper insurance in place, whether it's health insurance or life insurance. These are all follow-on services that we don't necessarily directly provide. But when a client walks out the door, we want to know, and it reflects better on us, that they have all those things covered and that there are other professionals or paraprofessionals in their lives that are high quality, that like we like to think of ourselves, who will follow them into the future.
That's important, because whether you are the spouse that has been very involved, right, and you've had hands on everything, chances are you may want a new professional since everything is separate now. And if you're the spouse that hasn't been involved in everything, I would think that person would need a lot of recommendations, assistance, handholding. I've heard the phrase that divorce lawyers are on the fence between divorce lawyers and psychiatrists. Is that true?
And tax advisors and financial advisors. I mean, the list probably is a lot longer than that. And we're always careful about the advice we give, because no matter how knowledgeable we are about other professional services, we know what we know and we know what we don't know. So that's why I think it's really important to set your clients up, if they aren't already set up, with the right professionals when they leave us and when they're with us. Because part of a lot of the cases that we're involved in deal with businesses that need to be valued, and tracing of assets or determining somebody's lifestyle. And these almost always require us to go outside of our firm to hire professionals to do that work as well.
So I know the firm handles a lot of high net worth cases along with all types of other cases, but let's take those cases for example. So the CEO's wife, the CEO, the actor or the actress, or the business owner. So more complicated assets. Let me ask you, what are the issues that they typically come to you with? What are they most concerned about? And if I was in their shoes, how would I know that Bierman or you, Tom Field, is the right attorney for me?
Well, experientially, that's the type of clientele that we have grown accustomed to representing. So whether it's an athlete, whether it's an entertainer, whether it's a C-suite executive at a Fortune 500 company, these are the kind of clients we know. So we've grown to understand them, their needs, and what service need to provide them, as well as the topics that are likely to come up. So when you mention a CEO type divorce by way of example, we know in the back of our heads, we have to be thinking, okay, what are the various different types of compensation that this person may or may not be receiving? Well, in addition to their salary, they're probably receiving options. How often are they vesting? What type of options are they? Are they receiving performance shares? how are those taxed in comparison to the options they're receiving? It can make your mind swirl a little bit. But again, those are things that we enjoy dealing with. We've got our clients who are in private equity or in hedge funds and have what's called carried interest, which is a future interest in profits. And it's a function of not doing guesswork and parsing out assets and maybe having them constructively held for one spouse into the future if they can't be divided. Again, complicated, not something that especially the non-moneyed or the non-earning spouse may be familiar with. But I'll go back to the hand-holding conversation. That's why we're good at what we do. We understand these issues. And for the client who is the CEO or is the entertainer, that's a comfort level for them too, because we can speak their speak. So when the other side is maybe learning about the information in the case, we're already in the know. And that's important to them as well.
Michael, you had mentioned, and Tom also mentioned previously, discovery. And some people may not understand what discovery means. Can you just take a step back, explain what that means and what that means to me coming to speak with you?
Yes. Discovery is basically the term that's referring to what you discover within a case in terms of information, gathering documentation to support the facts of the case. So discovery is done using a number of different tools that court rules allow you to do, the most common being simple document requests. What we do is issue a standard form for the most part, but it is tailored depending on what the issues are relating to whether they are CEO, how they're compensated, just relating to child custody related issues. We'll request paragraphs and paragraphs of different areas of documents that we're looking for to gather the information we need to ultimately put together a balance sheet for the case and the issues that arise within a case. So requesting documents is one way of doing that. Another way we do that is also by issuing what we refer to as matrimonial interrogatories. What that refers to is basically a set list of questions that the other side has to answer under oath. For example, list all of your bank accounts that you've had within the last 3 years, the balance of those accounts, the name of the institutions, things like that, whether you have a safety deposit box, all different areas that may arise within a case. And in our experience, we've added to some of the requests for documents based on things that we've seen come up within other cases. As a starting point, every party is required to fill out what we refer to as a financial affidavit. And this document itself acts almost as a roadmap to both the attorneys for each party, as well as the judge who will take a look at both parties' financial affidavits, which sets forth all of their assets, all of their liabilities, as well as all of their expenses. So we have a picture of what the family has for expenses, what their debts are, and their basic financial health. Once we have that, it kind of gives us an idea of where to navigate in terms of discovery, what additional information we need, what do we need to support some of the numbers that one of the parties used. Additionally, in terms of discovery, if we don't want to be patient in waiting for somebody to produce all of the documents, because on occasion you'll be waiting till you're blue in the face because people are busy and they don't always comply with deadlines of court rules, we also have the ability to issue subpoenas to banks, to employers, to schools. Whatever information we need and want to be sure that we're getting it accurately, we have the ability to issue subpoenas to all of those entities or individuals with the assurance that they'll give us an affidavit they've produced everything within their possession of control. There are a few additional things we can do in terms of discovery. Once you have all the information document-wise, you can also take both the parties' depositions. You can take third-party depositions as well to get statements from individuals that either support or contrast what someone's been telling you about the issues in the case. I wouldn't say that we do all of these things within every single case. Discovery is really something that you have to tailor to each case based upon the issues, because while some cases have similar issues that we've seen before, I would say that no two cases are the same and every case is unique. So you really have to tailor what you do in terms of discovery to what you're looking for. What do you need to prepare yourself for a trial, or what do you need to prepare a case to be settled on the correct terms?
Thank you. So, Tom, if I am the spouse that really has taken care of the children, I have no idea where our tax returns are filed. I have no idea what banks we bank at. My husband gives me an allowance each week, and that's really all I know. So when I come to this meeting and you ask me these questions and I don't know the answers, I feel a little hopeless, right?
Yeah, not at all. So that's one of the things that we try to really do to reassure our clients that it's okay. It's okay not to know, and you don't have to feel badly about it or embarrassed about it. That's your circumstance. For better or worse, whether that's why you're here seeing us or not, we take you as you come in. And again, it becomes a process. So we'll talk about how Illinois is a no-fault state. We'll talk about irreconcilable differences being the only grounds available to file a petition for dissolution of marriage. We'll talk about, as Michael and I have talked about, the discovery process, and then get into, okay, we may not know the finances, but baseline, here's how we calculate spousal support depending on the income level. And even though the potential client may not know exact figures, they may have a general idea, at least based on their lifestyle, where the income ballpark is, and that'll help us give them some peace of mind during that meeting. We can also conversely do that with child support. And then whether they know anything about the finances or not, assuming there are minor children involved, we can have really a robust conversation about parenting. We can talk about what an allocation judgment does and how it sets forth decision-making for parents in four major categories. We can talk about what a parenting agreement is going to look like from a time-sharing perspective and what kind of parenting time they think would be in the best interest of the children. From the decision-making perspective, we can talk about, do they think they can jointly make major decisions with their soon-to-be ex-spouse? When it comes to parenting agreements, I always tell potential clients, we can take your kids out of the litigation as early as possible. That, to me, is always a primary goal. And we'll get them a draft agreement within the first couple weeks, because that, again, takes some fear of the unknown away, and it'll give them something that they can grasp onto and critique for us. And then we can use that as a guidepost in future negotiations. But not knowing a lot of details is okay with us. That doesn't matter when they come in the first time.
It's good to know. I guess on the flip side, Michael, if I'm the CEO and my husband or wife doesn't know anything about our assets, and that's the way I'd like to keep it, and I am very clear with you that I don't want my spouse to know about all our matters, is there any way I can conceal it?
Well, we have to operate under our own ethical guidelines. So if something is requested of us and it's in our possession and control, we are obligated to produce it. If some people are weary of the process of discovery going on for an extended period of time, I generally advise people to give as much information as possible to try and short circuit how long a case could go on, because discovery is one way in particular that some of these cases that people may have heard about, divorce cases going on for extended periods of time, a lot of that time is done by either a party's unwillingness to cooperate with discovery or just gathering the information that's needed. For example, if you're doing a business valuation, it's going to take some time. And if you want to get the case over with quickly, give the expert, the other side, the information they need so that they can make their assessment and you can get out of the case quicker. But we don't make it a practice to hide anything. And frankly, we're prohibited from doing so. So we're not going to do that. As much as we'd love to help everyone, we're not putting our own licenses on the line for anyone, because we have many other clients to service as well.
Okay. Bezos and many other cases that this firm has handled, which I won't mention, that have been handled and settled in record time from the public's standpoint, right?
Sure.
We found out they were getting divorced, and shortly after they were divorced. And I know that happens very frequently with many of the cases that you handle. Just give me a little scenario as to how that happens.
A little scenario. So it can happen a few different ways. Sometime when cases that are high profile become public, they may have been going on behind the scenes for months, if not years, and just dealt with very confidentially. We tell our clients is that their confidence in us is so huge and such an obligation of ours that a lot of times we will have clients that will come in and they'll say, we don't want anything on file with the court. We want to negotiate this privately. We're open to alternative dispute resolution, which can be in mediation. You mostly could be in collaborative law, which is sort of a different form of mediation. And we won't sometimes file a case until the last minute. When we're ready, we already have a settlement struck, and we just need the filing as a technicality in order to actually get the people divorced. So that's a technique that we've used historically to keep things out of the press. Sometimes you can't help it.
Can't help what?
The press picking up a case, right? Because it didn't come from us. And sometimes it comes from the attorneys on the other side of the case or some other third party that gets whiffed of the case, and we can't help it. But to answer the question about how does it get done quickly, listen, attorneys can work collaboratively. So I know I used the word litigation before. But though we are litigators, we aren't always litigating. And the practical lawyers, of which we are always looking for a path to a resolution, the straightest point from A to Z. There will be some bumps in the road, but the faster we can get our clients in and out of this process, the healthier their families will be post-divorce, and the less they'll have spent on the process, which reflects better on us. So it becomes really a paid forward mentality where we want to take care of our clients. We want to do it as quickly as we can for their best interest all the way around.
Okay. Michael, top three things I should know before I pick up the phone or come see you.
Top three things. I would say to try and get as best of a picture as you can as to what the finances are. And it's okay if you don't. I think you should want to know what the issues are in your case so that we can direct the meeting as tailored to what your needs are as possible. And I don't know what the third were. Those were probably the most important.
Third one would be to call you.
To call me, absolutely. And sign up, yeah.
Tom?
So to echo some of that, I would say don't make yourself crazy researching lawyers. Even in the last couple of weeks, I've had a couple potential client meetings where I know I was either the fourth or fifth lawyer that these people were interviewing. One of them even asked me about two other people she was thinking about interviewing after me and what I thought about them, and puts me in an awkward spot. I try to be as honest as I can be, but the reality is you don't want to spend your life for weeks or months going around interviewing 10 different lawyers. At some point, you need to make a call. And along the way, you should make that call. And sometimes it's going to be on a gut if you don't have those really warm referrals. But do a little bit of research. There's enough information out in the world about lawyers if you really don't know anybody. But feel free to ask a lawyer, what's their approach to a case? What kind of team are they putting together to work on your case? How are they going to be efficient with your dollars? Those are important things to understand, and who the point of contact is on a day-to-day basis. All things that are important that they're entitled to know, because at the end of the day, it's a connection that you have with your lawyer. It's a business transaction, but it's important that you trust them. And so I don't think you need to interview 8 or 9 people to figure that out if you're going into it with some level of discernment as to who may be a good fit for you.
Well, I hope this has provided you with some good information regarding Divorce 101. If you'd like more information from Tom, you can go on to Bierman's website, www.biermanlaw.com, or Michael. Both of them have bios and other information about themselves. If you like this podcast, please share it on your social media. Please also like us on Facebook and follow us on LinkedIn. And please subscribe to this podcast because you'll hear again from Tom and you'll hear again from Michael and other attorneys at Bierman. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Divorce Talk. Visit our website at www.biermanlaw.com, where you can subscribe to the show so you'll never have to miss a single one. Please also follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn and subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating. Be sure to tune in next time for another enlightening episode.